Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Our presidential election series, 30 issues in 30 days, turns this week to debt and taxes. We'll kick this off with James K. Galbraith, professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin, author of books including Inequality and Instability, A Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis, published this year by the Oxford University Press. And a founder. Let's see, were you a founder of the American Prospect, Professor?
No, I was not, but I'm friends of the people who were.
Paul Krugman, Robert Kuttner, those economists. Thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
First on the debt. How big a problem do you think it is? President Obama inherited a $10 trillion national debt, but now it's up to $16 trillion on his watch. How alarming is that to you?
Well, that $16 trillion is a highly exaggerated number because a great part of that is held by the government itself. It doesn't really count for anything economically. The debt problem that we have has been, continues to be, the debt of the private sector, people's mortgages that they can't pay, and the burden of debt on companies, on households generally. The debt of the public sector exists because of the crisis. It's not a cause of anything, and it doesn't have it does not merit the hysteria that many people direct at it.
But the government debt of $10 trillion that Obama himself complained as he took office that he was inheriting from the Bush administration because of wars that were fought on deficit spending, an unfunded prescription drug program for Medicare. Are you saying that $10 trillion figure was also inflated?
Of course. And I'm not relying on President Obama for my economic expertise here. Anybody who's has a question about the economic impact of the national debt can look at the morning paper and check what is the interest rate that the United States government has to pay in order to borrow from the private sector, from knowledgeable people with lots of money, for, let's say, 20 or 30 years. And the answer is, you know, on the order of 3% for the very, very longest maturities. So it's to say the private sector is anxious to lend to the federal government in its current fiscal state because the private sector understands that the federal government is always going to pay on its obligations. In fact, the federal government is obliged to pay on its obligations by the Constitution of the United States.
But
People with money understand this very well.
At what point, in your opinion, do the really bad things that debt can cause actually begin to happen at the federal level? We already see some municipalities, there have been a few in California, declaring bankruptcy because of municipal debt. And obviously we know what's happening in Europe. And one of the things that eventually happens when the market loses confidence is that interest rates on new debt go sky high because lenders don't have confidence in the government's ability to pay it back.
Debt,
is the U.S. so immune
debt,
from that?
European debt are very different from the national debt of the U.S. government. A city has to have revenue to match its obligations, and when it doesn't, it can go bankrupt and it has to file, reorganize under the protection of the municipal bankruptcy law. In Europe, the countries in the Eurozone also have to have euro in the bank, euro that they cannot create, that they do not issue. And because of the crisis, a number of those countries, not all of them, but the ones on the periphery, are in a lot of trouble because of that. But this is not happening to Great Britain. It's not happening to Germany. It's not happening to Japan. And it's not happening to the United States. Why not? Because large countries at the national level are entirely liquid all the time. They are not subject to the kind of bankruptcy risk that a city or a country in the Eurozone is subject to. And the answer to your question, when is this problem going to emerge at the federal level, is very clear. It's never going to emerge at the federal level. There are problems that you can have from having a misguided national economic policy. You can have an overly rapid depreciation of the dollar, for example. You can have an inflation problem. In our current situation, those issues are almost incredibly remote. they are just not the problems that we're facing. The notion that the United States government is somehow not going to be able to fund itself is just belied by the experience of the last 30 years, but certainly by the last experience of the last 5 years, very clearly belied by it.
Listeners, we are going to take your calls all this hour on debt and Social Security and Medicare. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Debt and taxes, our overarching theme for this entire week in our 30-issue series. Tomorrow, by the way, we'll talk to Alice Rivlin, who was a budget director under Bill Clinton and was on the Simpson-Bowles Commission and also headed up her own deficit reduction commission. So Alice Rivlin in this series tomorrow. Right now, James Galbraith, professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin, and we have two other guests coming up, but we'll also get your voices in at 212-433-9692. And, Professor, I said we'll spend most of this hour on Social Security and Medicare as contributors to the debt. How do you see their role?
Well, Social Security is not a contributor to the debt, so we can leave that one aside. The question of Medicare, as in fact President Obama, I think, said quite clearly in his acceptance speech, the issue in health is the cost of health care, not Medicare as such. And the cost of health care is an important issue for both private sector providers and public sector providers. The difference is that Medicare is an extremely efficient way to provide universal health insurance to the elderly, and health insurance would not be available to the elderly at all without Medicare. So there is a great deal of confusion here involved in simply lumping Medicare and Social Security together as the issue, rather than taking health care and health care costs as the distinct problem to focus on. Social Security should be off the table altogether. Social Security has historic enemies and people have been fighting over Social Security since it was created, but especially since the early 1980s. But Social Security is, again, a very efficient, very effective way to prevent poverty amongst the elderly. It's a social insurance scheme that protects people from the risks of low income when they're old. It also protects their survivors and dependents, it should not even be in the discussion. It shouldn't be linked to the debt question because it really has nothing to do with it.
Well, I know that most economists say the Social Security problem is much less serious than the Medicare problem, and people should keep that in mind. But some of
we talk about the problem, what I think you mean is a mismatch between what is coming in payroll taxes and what is going out in benefits.
Precisely.
Or a projected mismatch in the future. A thing to bear in mind is that there is no necessary reason, as a matter of economics, why those two numbers need to be matched. There's a political reason, which is that we pay Social Security payroll tax to establish our right to a Social Security benefit later on. But that the two numbers should be matched over any time horizon is not necessary from any economic point of view. The U.S. government has been running deficits most years since 1790. The national debt has always grown, will continue to grow. And if some part of that is a gap between what comes in payroll taxes and what goes out in benefits, it's not a big deal. This issue is also somewhat artificial because for the moment and for all of the past 30 years, Social Security has been running a large surplus. Much more has been coming in payroll taxes than going out in benefits, and that's been piling up in the bonds that the Social Security Trust Fund holds.
But if you're saying that it's okay for Medicare and Social Security to be spending more than the payroll taxes dedicated to them are taking in, I guess because these are good, important programs and they're part of the government.
Even if they weren't, it's the Pentagon spends more than the Pentagon has no dedicated revenues to speak of, and yet it continues to spend.
But
the notion that any particular part of the federal government should be isolated and forced to match its revenues to its expenditure when other major parts of the federal government do not is not something which has any economic justification.
And I guess that's a debate to have, and we'll put that to our subsequent guests. We're doing that this hour with guests from left, center, and right in that order relative to each other. And our next guest will be from the centrist think tank, The Third Way. And they say,
I consider myself a centrist, by the way.
Okay, fair. Probably everybody considers themselves a centrist and an independent. But
right, absolutely. I'm just an economist. I'm telling you what the facts are as I see them.
Yes, and they say at Third Way that progressives are threatening the government spending that should be taking place, infrastructure and education, by borrowing so much to pay for Medicare and Social Security for the elderly. What do you think of that juxtaposition?
Well, first of all, the government is not borrowing to pay for Social Security for the reason I just gave. I mean, if you want to do this,
there's been this Social Security surplus over time.
Surplus,
you're
a huge surplus.
But over time, if the stats are true that there's going to soon be two workers for every one retiree, the ratio is so low that there's going to be a deficit, right?
No, I do not think that is necessarily the case. You have to remember that as the elderly population grows, that population of younger people who require public education is going to shrink, relatively speaking. Also, our productivity continues to rise, so those two workers have a much easier time supporting the retired population than was the case 40 or 50 years ago. So these kinds of stories, which have a superficial plausibility, I'll grant you that, do not stand up to close examination. Look, what Social Security does, it says, look, if you are elderly, your pension, your income comes from the income of the whole community. You don't have to rely on your own children, whom you may not have. If you do have, you may not have good relations with them. And if you are a working person, like myself, for example, I continue to pay into the Social Security trust fund, continue to pay payroll taxes, even though I no longer have parents who could potentially need support. So the whole community of working people is supporting the entire community of retired people. This is an insurance scheme. The community can continue to do this for as long as it likes. It's not something which has some inherent financial limit to it.
Jennifer in Cranford, you're on WNYC with James Galbraith. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I have a couple of questions for Mr. Galbraith. First of all, it seems to me we're in a liquidity trap, and we've got a lot of money sloshing around that nobody wants to borrow. That's the first issue. But then I thought that there was a sustainability problem. I thought that if we sustain a debt more than, say, 5% of GDP, that this presents a problem. So I wanted you to comment on that. And then the other question I have, which always scares me, is when are we at risk of hyperinflation, like Weimar Republic style? I mean, we're printing money. I mean, how does that work?
Okay. On the first point, you're right. There is a lot of liquidity sloshing around. This is a problem in the banking sector. It has to do with the fact that the banks don't have clients that they can lend to and borrowers with adequate collateral. And this is the main reason why the economy is stalled out. We do not have any recovery coming out of the financial sector, nor should we expect that to happen so long as people's houses are still falling in value. I think that's a very straightforward fact. It's got nothing to do with the federal budget or the federal debt. Your second question was about sustainability. If it were true that interest rates were about to go up sharply, which is in fact what many of these budget forecasts actually implicitly assume, then the debt would compound on the public debt would compound in relation to income. But it's not true. The Federal Reserve itself tells us that for the foreseeable future, it's going to hold the short-term rate at zero or practically zero. And the federal government will be able to issue short-term debt for as long as it likes, essentially at no cost. So the reality is that these budget forecasts are not consistent with what is in front of our eyes. If the Federal Reserve, in fact, were to raise the short-term interest rate by, let's say, 4 percentage points over the next few years, which you can find in a CBO document, every business would be bankrupt. Every house homeowner would be in foreclosure. The economy would completely collapse. It's not a realistic scenario. So the reality is that the current fiscal position of the United States government is not going to see the debt to GDP flying off to 300%. It just isn't going to happen. And so I think we need to re-examine those numbers in order to come up with a much more sensible and a much less scary set of budget projections. Now, the final point, hyperinflation. You know, hyperinflation is something that happens when a country's tax system collapses. That's what happens in Argentina under those conditions. It happened in Germany after World War I when the whole state collapsed. So long as the government of the United States functions and so long as people are paying taxes in a reasonable way, there isn't going to be hyperinflation in the United States.
Before you go, and Jennifer, thank you for your call. Professor Galbraith, before you go and we switch guests and points of view on this, as part of this segment, we've created what they call a sentiment matrix as a visual graph that people can see on our website from our data news team. And this sentiment matrix asks people two things and to place a dot on a graph that reflects where they are on this. How confident are you that Medicare and Social Security will be in place when you need them? And how willing are you to pay more in taxes to ensure that? And the results so far show that most of our listeners, at least those who are responding and actually plotting points on this matrix, are not at all confident and very willing to pay to preserve Social Security and Medicare. What do you think about that result, and what would you say to the people who are plotting those data points?
I think those both of those answers are very sensible and reflect the value that your listeners place on Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid too. The American public understands that these programs are the major remaining foundations of the middle class. They are what protect the American population from a future of poverty, a future of destitution. Medicare protects you from medical bankruptcy, which is a major reason why people go bankrupt. Why should one be anxious about the future of these programs? Because they have enemies. Because the entire, the entire political elite, and I include in this Republicans and Democrats, strongly supported by the financial sector, which is a dominant political force in our country, would like to see these programs put on the path to extinction. They would like to strangle them. They would like to cut them back and open up space for private fund managers and private insurance companies to move in, creaming off some of the people who, some of the very small number of people who would be able to finance their own retirements and their own medical care. So that is the question. If the broader population basically is very firm about protecting these social insurance schemes, which protect us all, then they will survive, and they can survive. And it's not taxes that people need to be prepared to pay. It's political sweat, blood, sweat, and toil that they need to get involved in to send a very clear message that Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid need to be protected, particularly in the immediate aftermath of the election, when politicians are not going to be under the kind of pressure that they're under now to be quiet about it.
James Galbraith, professor of government at the University of Texas and author of books including his latest, Inequality and Instability, A Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And don't forget, we want you to place a data point on that sentiment matrix of your own. I know that's a lot of big data news graphical sounding language there, but just go to wnyc.org/issues and you'll see how to do it on this x-axis and y-axis on the two questions of how confident you are that Social Security and Medicare will be in place when you need them and how much you're willing to pay more to ensure that. Go to WNYC.org/issues. And we'll continue with another point of view on this topic from the centrist think tank Third Way coming up in a minute.
A Romney-Ryan administration will protect and strengthen Medicare for my mom's generation, for my generation, and for my kids and yours. So our opponents can consider themselves on notice. In this election, on this issue, the usual posturing on the left isn't going to work. Mitt Romney and I know the difference between protecting a program and raiding it.
Paul Ryan from his convention speech, 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 7, Generation Debt. Not the young adults with student loans, but the baby boomers with all their coming Medicare and Social Security costs. And my next guest on this is Jim Kessler from the centrist think tank Third Way with a plan for Social Security, Medicare, and debt. Thanks for doing this, Jim. Welcome to WNYC.
It is my pleasure to be here.
Did you listen, first of all, to James Galbraith and have any response to his notion that a lot of the debt is fiction because it's money that the government owes to the government, money that it's borrowing from itself, and reminding us that Social Security has run a surplus for many, many years? It's just been spent on other things.
I listened to most of what he had to say. Look, he's a very thoughtful economist, but, you know, first of all, a lot of our debt today is not owed to Americans. A lot of our debt is overseas. And, you know, anyone can buy our treasury bills, and treasury bills are now often bought by folks overseas. So there is a transfer of wealth out of America. And the second point I'd say is, look, you don't need to have balanced budgets all the time. Homes don't have balanced budgets. Businesses don't have balanced budgets, and governments don't. There's always some borrowing. The question is, do you have a healthy amount of borrowing? Is the revenue that you're bringing in, is it sustainable so that borrowing is, you know, safe, and is it helpful for the economy? And we're at the point where our borrowing long term is really going to be a trouble for our economy. And in particular, what we're spending money on is mostly consumption items, not investment things that create future economic growth. So that's where I would differ with Mr. Galbraith.
And listeners, we can continue to take your calls on the intersection between elderly entitlements and debt, 212-433-WNYC. So, Jim, you have said to Democrats that their economic priorities are on a collision course. Their LBJ Great Society priorities, including Medicare, colliding with their JFK New Frontier priorities. Why do you see it as JFK versus LBJ?
Well, you know, look, I think both parties are going to need to move to the center to solve our deficit problems. And certainly Republicans have to get off the ledge that they're on that says absolutely no new revenue. But there's also a place where Democrats need to move as well. They need to move into an area where they're willing to consider fairly significant entitlement reforms that preserve those programs and save money. But one of the arguments we made to Democrats was, look, we as Democrats have really created two economic policy priorities, and one is the New Frontier programs of JFK, and those are the investment programs that were, you know, roads, bridges, and NASA, and National Science Foundation, and education, and help for kids to learn. And then we came up with the Great Society programs under LBJ, and those are the entitlement programs like Medicare and Medicaid, along with FDR's Social Security. In the 60s, the federal government spent three times as much money on investment programs as those entitlement programs. And this year, we're spending three times as much money on those entitlement programs than investment programs. And 10 years down the line, if the trends continue as they're projected, it will be 6-1. Well, one of our kids is fat and happy, and the other kid is emaciated, and I think we need to share some of the food to go to the economy.
So you recommend that Democrats do three things, and one of them is to seize on what you call Paul Ryan's convention gaffe of praising the Simpson-Bowles Commission. Let me play that moment from his speech.
Okay. He created a new bipartisan debt commission. They came back with an urgent report. He thanked them, sent them on their way, and then did exactly nothing.
Talking about President Obama creating Simpson-Bowles, then sending them on their way and doing absolutely nothing with the commission report that he commissioned. So why do you call this a gaffe by Ryan? And what policy opportunities do you think it presents to Democrats?
Well, it's a gaffe by Ryan because he was actually on the Bowles-Simpson Commission. He was one of the 18 members on the commission, and he voted against the recommendations of Bowles-Simpson. And I would even go further. I'd say if he had voted for it, Bowles-Simpson would be in law right now. His vote against it was the most influential vote against it. So it didn't get the two-thirds majority that it needed, and it went down.
Go ahead. No,
I think, you know, the
a little bit of an unfair attack on the president, on Bull Simpson. He didn't do absolutely nothing. He created it. I think if he had embraced it early, you could argue maybe we'd have that type of deficit reduction package. The other argument is it would have immediately become political and divisive. So it's hard to know what the right move is there. But you do have a plan that's out there. It's not perfect, but it is a very good plan that both parties are now saying they're trying to embrace, even though, you know, 20 months ago when it came out, people kept their distance.
You wrote a piece on Politico called Fixing Social Security is Progressive, in which you propose a reform plan that includes $2 in benefit cuts for every $1 of tax increases. And your first method for cutting benefits is to means test them. How would you do that?
There are a variety of ways, but, you know, one is that for those seniors who are at upper income, fully tax their Social Security benefits. So that's one way of doing it. And what we would do is that if you are at really high income, if you're earning, say, over $200,000 while you're a senior citizen, we say you shouldn't get any Social Security benefits.
Now, there are some who will say that will turn Social Security into a welfare program. And so instead of having the broad middle and upper class support that it has, it will become politically unpopular because it will be seen as another welfare program for the undeserving poor.
Well, I don't think it becomes a welfare program because the vast majority of senior citizens are earning less than $200,000. So I don't really buy that argument. The fact of the matter is Social Security is not on a sustainable course. The problem that we have in America is that over the next 30 years, the number of people over the age of 65 will double. And the number of people who are working age between the ages of 25 and 64 will go up by one-fifth. So essentially, those working age people pay for elderly folks. That's the way our tax system works. That's the way the payroll tax works. So that is a huge burden to put on the future working age and the future middle class people to essentially make sure that somebody who is very wealthy as a senior citizen is getting their full benefits.
And another of your proposals is to gradually raise the retirement age. How high, how fast?
Well, between 1980 and projecting out to 2026, the typical Social Security beneficiary will receive benefits for between 17 and a half and 18 years. Those are actuarial tables at work, okay? So what we're saying is after 2026, just make sure that beneficiaries on average receive between 17 and a half and 18 years in benefits. So it would slowly increase the retirement age to 68, I think, by 2040, and then to 69 by the middle of the decade between 2050 and 2060. And I think my best recollection is I think by 2080 it would be 70.
My guest on WNYC, Jim Kessler, the second of our three guests from left, right, and center, respectively, on the intersection between senior entitlements and the national debt. Jim is from the centrist think tank Third Way, proposing what he calls a progressive plan for fixing Social Security, including means testing the entitlements, gradually raising the retirement age, and extending the payroll tax to more higher income earners. And I want to take a phone call for you. Robert in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling from Queens. Actually, the Medicare was created by Franklin Delano Roosevelt only for elderly people.
Social Security.
But Medicare actually now is suffering the consequences of Obamacare. Right now, before you get an ambulance in New York City, you know, to transport somebody who lives on a big floor and no elevator, you have to have pre-authorization for at least 5-6 days in advance. They're putting a lot of brakes into a lot of things. Elderly people who are 80, 85 years old cannot use ambulance because under the Obamacare, you have to have pre-authorization. They're using a lot of actual excuses. So you don't have to use these services at all.
Is that new? I hadn't heard that before. And, Jim, I don't know if this is in your knowledge base, but is there something new under Obama regarding Medicare, where you have to get pre-authorization to use an ambulance? I don't think so.
I don't think so as well. And I think there's a lot of mythology about Obamacare and what it does to Medicare. Health care is clearly the huge driver on entitlement costs, and it's a huge problem for America. Obamacare heads in the right direction, both for Medicare and for private health insurance, in that what it's trying to do is replace the quantity of services that we have with more quality services. And that is a big change for the medical system. So, you know, you've heard people say in the past that we have the most expensive medical system, but our outcomes are no better than, you know, other successful countries. What that really means is there's a lot of things, procedures and tests and surgeries that are going on in the medical system in America that really shouldn't be done. And so the reforms that you try and create in those programs is to trim away the unnecessary care that occurs and keep, you know, the quality care, the necessary care.
And so the battle over how to control those costs is being fought right now between the president, who wants to have a panel of experts decide what's medically effective and reduce payments to doctors and hospitals for things that are deemed not to be, or the Paul Ryan plan, which would turn Medicare into a voucher system and have the savings come through the insurance company negotiations with the seniors who buy the policies. We have a doctor calling in who I think is concerned about the Obama method, and it's Joseph in Middletown, New Jersey. Joseph, you're on the air. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a physician who treats a large number of Medicaid patients as well as Medicare patients. My concern is that with Obama's plan, he's expanding dramatically. What people don't realize, I believe, that 50% of the additional people covered by health insurance will be covered by Medicaid, not some other type of health insurance. And as you dramatically increase the rolls, but the funding isn't there, we get paid very, very little money for the care we receive. And pretty soon, doctors like myself are going to be extinct. And then the only reason I can afford to see Medicaid patients currently is because I do also have a mix of private insurance patients. And as Obama's plan comes into fruition and more people are driven towards the welfare-based programs, you're not going to have physicians like me who can stay afloat, who are going to be able to treat these patients.
Joseph, thank you very much for chiming in with that. And this is one of the biggest Republican critiques about the Obama approach, putting the pressure on the providers rather than on the patients, Jim. And I wonder if you have a third way kind of thought about that. You know, I've interviewed many Republican politicians who say, look, if you put all the pressure on the providers, people are just going to get out of the business and stop taking Medicare patients.
So let me give you a couple of third way ideas on that. One is because I think your caller has a good point. You know, my brother's a doctor as well, so I've heard it many times. You know, Medicaid is puts a tight squeeze on providers. A few things. One is over 25% of Medicare expenses is the last year of a person's life. Okay, so right now I'm focusing on cost. Much of that care is completely unnecessary, and isn't even what the patient would want if that patient was involved in the decision of those final weeks of their lives. So if we actually did something in which we were encouraging patients before they were having, you know, as elderly having, you know, being incapacitated, to actually decide what they wanted their final weeks or months of their life to be like in terms of care, we would save a lot of money and patients would feel better, you know. So one of the things that we could do is more effectively deal with end-of-life care and have that be, you know, both be better for the patients and better for the taxpayer. And then if you were able to do something significant there, some of the other areas where doctors feel squeezed on Medicaid, you'd be able to make more room because you'd be spending far less on the several hundred thousand dollars that you're spending mm-hmm. on the last week of someone who's 93 years old, who is not conscious during that entire week.
And we're conflating Medicaid and Medicare a little bit, but the issues are basically the same.
It's money.
I guess,
yeah.
And I don't want to dwell on this, but of course what you just laid out becomes such an emotional and political hot button, because then many conservatives and others will say, well, this is the so-called death panels where the law encourages doctors to encourage patients not to get all the treatment that could keep them alive.
Well, the truth of the matter is that if you left it up to providers, patients would get far more treatment than they'd want to have, because the way our system works is the more treatment you provide, the more money you get. So the incentive isn't actually for doctors to say, do less. The incentive is for doctors to say to do more. But if you just had a situation in which, and it's been done experimentally in parts of the country, where they're providing that advice to patients and having and helping patients just like you would, a lawyer would help you with your will, you know, the patient's wishes would be done, not the doctor's wishes or not the hospital's wishes that is seeking a reimbursement.
We're going to switch guests in just a minute as we continue on the intersection between senior citizen entitlements and the national debt. I want to take one more quick question for you from a listener, and it's Rena in Somerset. Hi, Rena. You'll get 30 seconds for your question. Thank you so much for calling.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to say, you know, there's a lot of talk about the growth of Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security, and that people are getting less returns. But what about military spending? I mean, you know, we're spending a lot on military, but there's not much returns in terms of it. It goes waste every year.
Rena, thank you very much. And I wonder, Jim, if Third Way has a similar or parallel kind of paper on military spending, which is the other 800-pound gorilla in the federal budget.
There needs to be a reduction in spending in nearly all areas of the government. I'd say the areas where it doesn't need a reduction in spending is our public investments in roads and bridges and highways and new energy and research and science and that sort of thing. The Defense Department definitely needs a trim, and I'll tell you one place where it really, really, really needs a trim. Military retiree health care. It is a huge, they have, you know, military retirees. I'm not talking about veterans and the veterans benefits they get, but just your standard military retiree has the most generous health care retirement system in the nation. It's, they should still have a great system, but there needs to be, and it's something that Secretary Panetta, when he was defense secretary, talked about. It is the biggest driver of costs in the Pentagon right now. Retiree health care. Big problem.
Jim Kessler, Senior Vice President for Policy at the centrist think tank Third Way. Thank you so much for being one of our three voices on this.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More in a minute. Issues in 30 days, all this week about debt and taxes. Today, debt, taxes, and senior entitlements. Our last guest, as we continue across your radio dial from left to right on the political spectrum, is James Capretta, visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He has written How to Replace Obamacare. James, thank you for coming back on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back. I'm glad to be with you.
What do you think, basically, first about the plan we just heard from the centrist Third Way think tank? Raise the retirement age gradually to 68, means test the entitlements, and expand the payroll tax so people pay it on the first $190,000 of income. Today it's on less than $110,000.
Well, two out of three isn't bad. You know, I'm very much for raising the retirement age, and I am in favor of also looking at how to flatten the benefits, so to speak, and make it more progressive. And frankly, you could probably increase it a little bit on the very low end while taking it down for people that are upper income.
That's the means testing.
Means testing, excuse me, yeah. But in terms of raising the payroll tax, I'm not in favor of that. I mean, I think it has very detrimental labor force impacts, and it's already quite high around the world. As countries have tried to solve their social insurance problems with payroll tax increases, many countries have. It's exacerbated unemployment problems, and quite frankly, as a supply, you know, people supply labor at a less rapid rate when they have such a high tax on labor. So I really think we need to solve this problem without raising the payroll tax if we can.
The Democrats and many centrists say the Republican position of zero new revenue has to change. You can't just dig our way out of $16 trillion of the national debt with spending cuts alone unless you do great harm to both seniors and kids coming up today. Do you disagree with that?
I do. I think, you know, if you look at the long history of the fiscal wrangling that's been going on in this country, really it's a battle that's been going on for basically 30 years. We have never done any really serious entitlement reform. We did some modest changes in the Social Security benefit in 1983 in the Reagan years that's having some effect and did put some downward pressure on Social Security to a modest extent. But in terms of seriously thinking about how to restructure these programs and make them workable and sustainable over the long run, we haven't done. And so we've drifted into a situation where we're now spending well above what was the historical norm and what was really anticipated when they were enacted. We're now spending just on the big three programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, close to 11% of GDP on those programs alone. Back in the mid-70s, it was about 4 to 5%. So we've added 6 percentage points of our budget to those programs because they haven't been reformed very well. And we're headed toward adding another 6 percentage points over the next 25 years. So my view is that, you know, we really need to spend a lot of time on entitlement reform, think about how to handle that, how to do that right, make the program sustainable and viable for future generations, and then we can look at the revenue side of the equation.
Well, what would you do before looking at the revenue side of the equation to make it more sustainable, in addition to the two things that Jim Kessler from Third Way was talking about, raising the retirement age and means testing the benefits?
Well, I think the biggest thing we need to do is rethink our health care system. And, you know, obviously that gets into a much bigger conversation about how to think about the health care law and so on. But my own judgment is that we need to move toward a system where the consumer is participating on the margins in some of the choices of the plans that they sign up with. That will put a lot of pressure back on the delivery system to become more efficient. We can do it in a way where the consumers are not overly exposed. I think the bidding system that Congressman Ryan is proposing as a vice presidential candidate, bidding for the Medicare benefit, you know, for everyone under the age of 55 is a place to start. And we need to do that across the board in the broader health system as well, so that competition and market forces can put some downward pressure on the cost structure. I think, frankly, if we think we're going to be able to regulate our way to a better health system, I think we're going to be very, very disappointed. We're going to need to rely on a more decentralized system of cost control where the government is providing oversight of the marketplace, but really it's consumers acting and wanting to find lower cost options that will drive the system to control costs. That's what we need to do, and that will have a big effect on the trajectory of Medicare spending going forward, as well, if it's done right, also in Medicaid.
Ryan has a steep political mountain to climb, it seems, with respect to getting seniors to think that you call it the bidding system. I guess that's the premium support system that he calls it. Others characterize as a voucher plan. To be accepted and for seniors to think it's a good idea. Here's a short clip of Ryan speaking to the AARP on Friday.
The first step to a stronger Medicare is to repeal Obamacare because it represents the worst of both worlds.
And that was about Obamacare. He got a similar reception when referring to his own Medicare plan. But why does the voucher plan and that dynamic between individual senior and insurance company make sense in terms of a power relationship? Critics say 80-year-olds with their 80-year-old brains and their 80-year-old stamina, not that all 80-year-olds are deteriorating much in either category, but versus powerful insurance companies for advantage in the marketplace. Really?
Well, look, first of all, your listeners must know that clip that Congressman Ryan giving that talk there, you know, it's a very different audience at an AARP National Convention than at seniors groups all across. He's given that talk many, many times to senior groups around the country and oftentimes to a very receptive audience.
And that's a fair point, AARP.
It's a very biased
convention-goers.
Convention-goer reception. So, and also, there was some applause in that speech. So I don't want your listeners to get a misimpression. Secondly, we have bidding in Medicare already. We have a Part D program that at the time was enacted. All the critics said it'll never work. Seniors will be too confused. Costs are sore. Without the government regulating the prices, things will be terrible. Totally and completely wrong. The program is now in its seventh year. Premiums are stable. Costs have come down. Seniors are saving boatloads because the decision process of putting them into these plans has allowed them to save huge amounts of money on generic substitution because it's much more clear and visible and transparent to them and their family members how much they could save by switching. Generic substitution has gone up. I just got a presentation on this from about 45% pre-drug benefit to about 70 to 80% on average and going to 90% in the best plans. So seniors, with the help of oftentimes of family members, are able to navigate and save huge amounts of money when the choices are there and they can see how much they would save by switching to a lower cost, high quality option. The same thing can be done in the rest of the program. It's granted there are some complications. It's a big deal to do this for physician and hospital care. But a lot of care that is provided by seniors is actually fairly routine, routinized. It's done on many, many seniors. One can then transparently price it, and it can be done through an insurance plan. If you want delivery system reform, don't expect the government to be able to deliver it. Only a marketplace can deliver it.
You know, coincidentally, I gave a talk yesterday to a group of about 100 seniors at a senior living facility in the New York area. It wasn't a political rally. You know, I was talking mostly about the media. But I was curious also about the group's experience on this issue. And it was mostly Democrats based on their responses. But these were pretty well-off people who had had professional careers. And on the personal question I asked the group, who serves you better, Medicare or the private insurance carriers you had when you were working? Almost no hands went up to choose the private carriers. Does that surprise you?
Not at all. No, I mean, basically, nobody likes their insurance company, including myself, you know. So,
but they seem pretty happy with Medicare.
Well, I mean, what's not to like about Medicare when the system is basically being, you know, paid for? The government pays the claims on their behalf. They're able to sign up with a Medigap plan that fills in their cost sharing. Their employers oftentimes will wrap around the Medicare plan. So a lot of times at the point of service for the current senior, they're not paying any costs at the point of service whatsoever. It's not surprising in that kind of a structure that people say, hey, it's pretty good. I don't have to deal with any costs at all when I go see my doctor or I need care. That's fine by me. You know, it's terrific. Of course, that's exactly the reason why volume in the Medicare program is off the charts and has been for more than three decades and has contributed very substantially to our cost problem as well as to the fragmentation and lack of coordination throughout the health system.
So a lot of the trick really is to ration, if I can use that dirty word, care or find a system where people self-ration. Romney said self-deport. Maybe this is self-ration. Or where the government, under the Obama system, decides what's cost-effective and then squeezes the doctors and the other providers so they don't provide it. Is that do you see it like that?
I wouldn't characterize exactly the way you did, Brian, but I think you're on the right track. Let me try it a slightly different way.
And we have about a minute and a half left.
The way I would describe it is that if in a marketplace, you know, basically seniors should be given a choice. This is for the future. This isn't for current seniors. This is down the road when people retire into the program. They'd be given a choice that if they want to pay a higher premium for a fee-for-service environment where they do all the picking themselves to go to a doctor and hospital, that's fine, but they may have to pay a slightly higher premium. But if they go to a more organized system like a Kaiser Permanente or, frankly, to something like Intermountain Healthcare or Geisinger Health Plan, there are many good integrated systems around the country that make the system more organized and they direct them to the kind of physician services they're going to use, especially on the specialty care. If they pick that kind of an option, they'll save a lot on their premium by doing so.
Right.
That's the kind of choice that seniors are going to have to face and, frankly, our country is going to have to face. Honestly, fee-for-service Medicare is not always the highest quality.
James Capretta, visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He has written on how to replace Obamacare. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you.
James Capretta, the third of our three voices from left, center, and right on the intersection of debt and senior entitlements. Tomorrow we continue our week on debt and taxes in our 30-issue series with none other than Alice Rivlin, who was on the Simpson-Bowles Commission and ran her own commission on deficit reduction. She was a budget director in the Clinton administration. Now, don't forget, we're partnering with longform.org during this 30-issue series. There are great articles to read, longer-form articles about these topics. Go to our 30 Issues page at wnyc.org/issues.